Thank you for attending the 2020 Sunstone Digital Symposium, session 351, titled How Faith and Rationality Are Incompatible. The audio from the session will be available to purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of this session will be available in the Whova app for the remainder of 2020. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, there is more than one way to Mormon. We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. Our presentation today. Of course, all are free to believe whatever they want, as long as they're not harming others. But not every belief is rational. In this presentation, Spencer Wright will demonstrate the ways in which faith-based beliefs are incompatible with rationality. Recognition of this incompatibility can be both a cause for grief and a cause for gratitude. We'll look at it from both angles. Spencer Wright has a master's degree and is attending law school. He is also the author of three books, one of which discusses this topic. I'll now turn the floor over to Spencer.
Hey everybody, welcome. I'm Spencer Wright. What I'm going to do is take about, this is a 90 minute window for the presentation, but I'm going to take about 60 to 65 minutes to do the presentation so that there'll be plenty of time for questions afterwards. I'm assuming that there's probably at least a person or two in the audience who's totally happy to hear that the faith and rationality are incompatible, and probably at least a person or two that thinks that that's awful that I'm even saying something like this. So I want to make sure that we have plenty of time so we can get your questions answered at the end. Okay, so I just want to start out, first of all, because this is kind of a prickly subject, I just want to start out by saying that I only care about beliefs when they spill out into the real world and when they cause harm for others. Beliefs that don't cause harm for others has nothing to do with me. It doesn't matter to me whatsoever what you believe. And for that matter, whatever you believe is not really my business anyway. I only care about beliefs that cause harm to others. But once beliefs cause harm to others, then they become open to criticism if the beliefs are the cause of that harm. Otherwise, believe whatever you want. The people that I have met to attend Sunstone are some of the kinds of people who their beliefs lead them to do good for others. And so I'm guessing that probably most of the people, if not all of the people watching this presentation, that portion of this does not apply to you. I just see really fantastic people who are trying to do good in the world, trying to help others, and their beliefs, even if their beliefs are not rational, are still actually helpful to others. And so this presentation is not to disparage your beliefs, to say you shouldn't believe them just because they're rational. I'm more concerned about harm than I am concerned about whether a belief is of itself rational or irrational. All that said, none of that changes the facts that some beliefs just simply aren't rational. And so today what we're going to talk about is an objective method for evaluating whether belief is rational or irrational. We use a lot of assumptions and intuition about how we find out what is true or what's reasonable, what's rational. But that's a problem, because what happens is we seem to kind of skirt what it is that makes something rational or irrational when we have our pet beliefs, when we have the things that we want to believe are true. And so we end up kind of changing the parameters for how we determine whether something is rational or not. So what I'm going to do in this presentation, I'm going to get super basic about what happens to our brains while we're intuitively thinking about whether something is rational or irrational, and how we come to that conclusion. But what I'm hoping to demonstrate, the point of this presentation, is to demonstrate that not only are these different processes, but what we're doing when we think something is rational versus something that's faith-based, but they're actually contradictory processes. We can't do them at the same time. One of the questions that had already been asked is, so what about really smart people who are both rational, they're very rational people, they have PhDs, they're, you know, respected in the scientific community, but they're also religious. And so my point is not to say that someone who is very highly intelligent, highly rational, can't also be religious. What I'm saying is the mental processes that allow you to think rationally and the mental processes that allow you to think faith-based can't happen at the same moment in time in the same brain. Okay, let's begin. So we're going to start with a little magic. This is sort of a little to break the ice, but also that we're going to actually discuss this a little bit later in the presentation. Okay, so here comes the magic trick. Are you ready? Okay, I didn't hear one laugh from the audience, so I'm hoping at least somebody thought that was funny. But from a show of hands, or well, there's not, you can't even do a show of hands. Just in your mind, you can think to yourself, how many people think I used genuine magical powers to perform that magic trick? And so, and to split it kind of a little bit more, even split it into more succinct categories, think in terms of one of these and say which one most closely aligns with what you think I just did. One, I definitely use magical powers to link the rings. Two, I probably use magical powers. Three, I probably didn't use magical powers. And four, I definitely didn't use magical powers. And as you're contemplating that, I'm gonna wager that if everyone's being serious and not just making a joke answer, most of us fall into one of the last two categories. And most importantly for this presentation, we all have the same intuitive reasons for falling into one of those categories, meaning I probably didn't use magic. And now I was the one who did the trick. I feel pretty confident that I know how the trick was done. But even though I'm the one who performed the trick, I'm still open to the possibility that that was magic, that it required magic for me to do that the magic trick. And also, I'm pretty sure that I didn't use magic. And so I want you to think along those lines as we're talking about this and think about why it is that we intuitively are pretty sure I didn't use magic right there. What led us to that conclusion that it's irrational to believe that magic was employed in order to perform that magic trick? So again, just want to do another disclaimer that believe whatever you want. Beliefs can have values independent of rationality. If you have a belief that is you determine is actually an irrational belief and you want us to believe it, as long as you're not hurting anybody else, that's not my business. Beliefs can give you lots of other value besides, you know, for one, they can make you feel good or they can get you through a tough time or whatever the case may be. That's all just fine. And I can still love people and we can still be friends even if somebody has a belief that is an irrational belief. This is not my purpose to come here to talk you out of your irrational beliefs. My purpose is simply to talk about what it is that makes beliefs rational. And so my thesis is that rational and faith-based thinking are incompatible, but more than that, they're actually diametrically opposed to one another. Something that when I discuss this with people, it kind of gets a little prickly, but I use the example of leprechauns frequently. And I just want to make sure that it's understood that I'm only using leprechauns because I believe most of us intuitively see the beliefs in leprechauns as irrational. And I want to uncover the objective basis for the intuitive feeling so that we can apply it to other beliefs. And it's also important to note that even though I'm using the idea of leprechauns as a foil here, I'm actually open to the existence of leprechauns. I don't automatically start from the assumption that leprechauns don't exist. And I can also tell you objectively what would cause me to believe in leprechauns. And the same can be said. What I'm going to lay out here as far as the objective basis that I'm using to evaluate claims, I would use that same same evaluation for any belief and any beliefs, not just leprechauns. And also, it's important to note I don't believe in leprechauns. So even being open to the possibility and having a criteria by which I can determine whether, like, evaluate claims of leprechauns, I still don't believe in leprechauns. Okay. So this would have been more fun probably in a group setting where I could actually hear what you're saying and doing what you're saying. But just in your mind, I want you to think about how you define the term rational. The problem that I run into almost exclusively, there have probably been a few exceptions, But the problem that I've run into almost exclusively is that when I ask somebody to define the word rational, they give me answers, but those answers themselves are not necessarily objective. There have been a few exceptions, but for the most part, I hear answers such as reasonable, logical, sensible, and these all sound like, you know, good answers to tell us how rationality is defined. In fact, if we look at the dictionary, we might see that it's based on or in accordance with reason or logic or any of those synonyms that we use, such as reasoned, sensible, coherent, those types of things. The problem with using a synonym to define the word rational is that if we were to say rational is reasonable, then I would still have to ask, well, then how do you define reasonable? And so reasonable might be defined back again by rational or by any of those other synonyms. The problem is that when we're doing that, we're creating basically a circular definition for the word rational. And so we're not really pinning it down to something objective. But the problem, of course, is when we have a pet belief that we want to claim is rational, then we end up saying, well, yeah, sure, it's reasonable. Well, how do you evaluate that it's reasonable? Well, because it's rational. And so by the time we've gone through the entire process, we haven't actually pinned it down what causes a belief to be either rational or reasonable. And then we're essentially left with the inability to actually declare or decide or evaluate whether a belief is rational or irrational. So there are people like Alistair McGrath, who is both a scientist and a Christian apologist, and he's asked this question frequently, and of course his answer is contrary to my answer, but notice the way in which he answers this question. He says, when it comes to, this is a faith-based thinker, somebody who believes in faith-based claims. And so he's asked the question, are faith and rationality compatible? And so he says, faith has its own rationality. It's not the same as you would find in everyday situations. For me, what he has done here is basically conceded my point. So even though he's trying to say, yeah, they're rational, it's just faith has its own rationality. You have to use a special kind of rationality to demonstrate that they are compatible. And so he's basically already saying that he doesn't believe that the everyday situation rationality actually is compatible with faith. I need to have a different, special, you know, kind of rationality in order to say that they're compatible. And so in my estimation, what Professor McGrath is doing is circumventing the issue. He's kind of cheating by playing a word game where instead of taking the everyday situation definition for rationality, he's creating a new definition and from that saying that they're compatible. What I want to do, and this would be something like somebody saying, well, everybody wears shoes on their head. It's just a different kind of shoe than you'd find in everyday situations. And so we could say, well, yeah, people wear a hat on their head, right? So we could call that a shoe, but that doesn't really answer the question whether or not people actually wear shoes on their head. If we're kind of cheating by playing word games, that's not really solving the problem. And so so this is an important question. It's a question that people ask in, you know, in the ivory towers of academia to discuss whether faith and rationality are compatible. But we just need to make sure that we're honest about the answers that we're giving, that we're using the terms as they are normally used in everyday situations, and then answering the question. Okay, so the problem with doing either of those things, when we're talking about kind of playing a word game where we're shifting around the meaning of the word, or if we're using a synonym, is that these definitions are not objective. So what we're going to do, what I'm going to do for the rest of the presentation, I'm going to take just a quick little detour, but for the rest of the presentation, I'm going to go through and talk about an objective standard that we can use for defining when something is rational, that's not using synonyms, but that's actually connecting itself to an objective evaluation standard. But just before we do that, let's take a little detour and also talk about how we define faith. And so I want to, I know that this was actually also one of the questions that was asked prior to the presentation. How do I define faith? And that's what I'm going to talk about that in just a second. But I want you to think about, how do you define faith? And so again, there are just as there are many different definitions for rationality, there are also many definitions for faith. What I'm trying to do is pin it down to the way in which we most commonly use these terms. And so what I want to talk about it is from the way in which we intuitively use the term faith, like the way that it's used in the Bible, for example. And so let's look at that versus other ways that people possibly use the word faith. So we have two lines here. And what I want to do is kind of contrast what's going on between these two lines. So this orange line, this is what I would call religious faith. This is like belief in supernatural claims, that sort of thing. So religious faith doesn't, I don't necessarily mean within the confines of religion. I just mean that religious faith uses this definition for faith with quite a bit of frequency. So what I'm doing here on the two axes are, I'm talking about the amount of faith, what we have in terms of whether somebody would have low faith in that belief or high faith in that belief, and then the amount of empirical evidence, the physical evidence for that claim. And so if I'm claiming that there is a dinosaur outside, so that doesn't necessarily mean that it's within the confines of a religious belief system, just something that is out of the ordinary or whatever, or I could say there's a dog outside, right? But the point is, if I were saying there's a dinosaur outside, well, the amount of evidence that I have for that claim is actually very low. And so if somebody has a great deal of confidence in that belief, then that's where they would land on this diagram. Now, the reason why I kind of contrast these two definitions is because I hear religious people very frequently say to atheists, they'll say, well, you also have faith. You also believe, you require faith for your beliefs too. Even scientific claims require faith as well. And so I just wanted to contrast and show what that actually looks like and why that's such a distinctly different claim than believing a claim with a lack of evidence or even contrary to the evidence. So if someone who is saying that the scientist has a belief, what we would say is when there is a low amount of evidence, there's also a low amount of faith. And then when there's a high amount of evidence, there's a high amount of faith. And so we could use the term faith to describe this blue line, but really we have to capture the reality that these two definitions for faith are actually exactly opposite when we're using a contrast of empirical evidence. When we're saying with the amount of empirical evidence, your likelihood to believe or have trust or have confidence in the belief is actually exactly opposite. And another point that I just wanted to point out is that also on the religious faith line, like in Alma 32 is a good example of why this the orange line ends up over here. That Alma 32 says that once your faith has been sustained by evidence or whatever the case is, then your faith is dormant. So you don't need faith anymore once you have the evidence. And that's the reason why the orange line is actually falling in an exact opposite direction. I just wanted to point out one other thing about the idea of faith is that for this presentation, I'm talking about a literal belief and a claim as opposed to some other type of definition, some other type of thought about the idea of faith. I'm actually a big fan of Shinto. I love Shinto. I think Shinto is a fantastic belief system, but I don't take the claims literally. And so Shinto to me provides a moral system, an ethical system, but I don't take the stories of the gods of the kami literally. Morals and values are something that it's quite different from what I like the moral of the story. What's the moral that I get out of the story of a scripture or something like that? That's very different than whether the story itself is true. So morals can be judged by their outcome or, on an empirical basis. When we say it's good to do unto others as they have done unto us, we can confirm that that's actually a true moral, a true principle based on the outcome that comes from that. But just because they are, you know, the morals or the values can have an objective outcome that doesn't then transfer back and say that the story itself is true. Behind me, you can see there's a mask. This is called a tengu. It's a kami, a yokai in Japanese mythology. There's stories about tengu who teach martial arts to people, and those martial artists become, you know, great martial artists as a result of this. Well, I could say that I'm studying these books that are supposedly written by tengu, and those and I can become a better martial artist as a result of that. But that doesn't actually mean that they're improved because tengu are real. It means I improved because the principles that I'm learning are real. So again, when we're talking about faith, for the purpose of this presentation, I'm only just talking about claims about a literal belief in something that itself has, we either have no evidence to support it or even contradictory evidence to support it. Okay, so like as an example, to kind of contrast that orange line with that blue line, let's take these two claims. One is that the sun will rise tomorrow. And you know, for you literalists, this is what I'm talking about from an apparent view, from the perspective of ourselves, not the actual way that the sun goes around, or the earth goes around the sun. And claim two is that the sun won't rise tomorrow. And so someone might look at these two claims and say they both require faith. But the reality is we mean something almost exactly opposite from one another when we are talking about the confidence that somebody has in this claim. Claim one, I have confidence in it because the sun has risen every day for my entire life and, you know, as far back as history is concerned. Where claim two would require me to go contrary to the actual evidence of what has happened up to this point. And so if I were to have claim in faith in claim one, if I were to have faith in claim one, that would be kind of like the blue line. I have a great deal of evidence supporting it, and so I have a great deal of confidence in it. Where claim two would require me to go against the evidence, and so in order to have faith in that would require something wholly different than claim one. Okay, this is actually just kind of saying what I just barely said a second ago. If we're saying that both require high faith, we're actually meaning the exact opposite thing. So when we're talking about faith for the purpose of this discussion, I'm talking about the orange line faith. Okay, some people say that I'm just making up a new meaning here. I'm making up new meanings for faith. I'm making up new meanings for rationality. As far as faith is concerned, I think I'm pretty fair saying that this is the definition from faith or definition of faith as understood in the Bible. I think that nearly any example you can find in the Bible where they're talking about faith, having faith as a virtue, they are talking about that orange line faith. They are not talking about the blue line faith. And so I think I'm pretty fair with that. For the definition that I'm going to give for rationality, it's actually maybe a slightly fair critique to say that I'm making up a new term for rationality, a new definition for rationality. But I will say that I believe that this is how we actually think intuitively when we think about rationality. And so is this actually the correct definition? I don't know, but I think it's pretty fair that I am using it in this way. And so if you want to come up with another definition, that's just fine. We can chat about that and we can talk about what you think would be a better definition for rationality. But if you're going to do that, then we also need to make sure that your definition is objective and also that it's too easy to cheat our intuition when we don't do that. So just make sure that you are at least understanding the way that I'm using the terms, and then we can talk about different terms later. Okay. Also, just to make sure, one other point, which is there's a couple of other little things here in terms of philosophy. I'm trying to avoid philosophy as much as possible as we're getting down deep into the stuff. But just to make sure that what we're really talking about here is epistemic rationality. We're talking about good reasons to have confidence in a claim. And then also, because this comes up, I know this doesn't seem like it's the most important point at this moment in time. But this kind of comes up very frequently when I'm discussing this with others, that rationality is not a question of ontology. So ontology is a branch of philosophy. There's a specific area of ontology which is basically saying, what is the real of reality? What is the true truth of reality? And so what my point in saying this is to say, rationality does not guarantee that we have happened upon the truth. We don't know that just because, so I can objectively pin down what is the rational explanation for something, the rational explanation for a thing, but that doesn't guarantee that it's actually the real true answer. So that leaves us kind of with two sides of things, right? So that could be that something is rational and it's not true, or something is irrational and it is true. And so that's certainly a possibility. So we have to be open to that possibility, but just recognize that being objective about rationality doesn't guarantee the truth of the thing that we're talking about. Okay, another thing is just still kind of slightly dabbling into philosophy is that what I'm proposing here is not naturalism. Naturalism is the argument that only that which is empirical is true. And I am not making that argument. And I know that I'm going to say a few things that makes it sound like I'm making that argument, but I am definitely not making that argument. I'm also not even presuming a foundational standard. I'm not starting with axiomatic truths about reality and then building off of those. I'm actually starting with none of those things. And so as we're going through, I just want to keep pointing out this is not naturalism, this is not foundationalist standard of what we're going to talk about. Okay, so what I am going to do, though, is I'm going to give seven assertions for the objective standard by which we can determine whether something is rational to believe. Then there'll be an eighth assertion at the end, but it's basically just kind of summing up everything. Okay, the first assertion is rationality starts with measurement. Now, right, even saying that, the very first thing that goes in somebody's mind is they're thinking, oh, you're trying to argue naturalism. You're trying to say that if we can't measure it, then it's not true. And that's actually not what I'm saying at all. All I am saying by this is we have no other starting point. There's actually no other way to declare anything objectively one way or the other if we don't start with measurement. Measurement is just the starting point. It's not even just because you measure something, that doesn't automatically mean that what you are measuring is real. And just because you can't measure something doesn't automatically mean that it's not real. All I'm saying is something is being measured and that measured thing demands an explanation. That's all we're saying by we're saying rationality starts with measurement. The other point is that unfortunately we are subjective, empirical beings who can only get things into our brain with our senses. And so again, what I'm saying is, this is the only starting point. It's actually the only a way that we can begin, the only place that we can actually begin. When we talk about the sun rising, when I was saying it's rational, intuitively, we can see how the more rational of those two claims that I talked about earlier about the sun, we can see that one of those claims is more rational than the other. We can see that the claim that the sun is going to rise tomorrow is more rational than the claim that the sun isn't going to rise tomorrow. But the only way that we can actually make that determination is because we are starting with measurement. We're starting with the fact that the sun rises, has risen every day. That's the basis by which we claim that's the basis that we determine that claim is the most rational of the two claims. So this isn't starting from some a priori knowledge about the nature of the sun. It's starting with the measurement of rising each sun. And in fact, if the sun didn't rise tomorrow, it would be irrational to claim that the sun did rise tomorrow. So again, each one of these statements is dependent upon our ability to measure the state of the sun in order to do that. I gotta get cooking here. I just realized I'm kind of going slow here. Okay, if there was nothing to measure, there would be no rationality whatsoever. In the absence of measurement, if you were just a kind of a floating consciousness in a realm of nothing to measure whatsoever, then everything would be rational and everything would be irrational at the same time. So every claim that we make about reality has some basis in rationality. When I say the hypothesis of gravity is based on an attraction of an object's center of mass to another object's center of mass, each one of those elements of that claim has some sort of basis in measurement. So when I talk about attraction, when I'm talking about two objects being attracted to each other, I can't describe that without having some form of measured effect, something that's being measured. When I'm saying these two objects, I'm talking about two objects that are measurable. When I talk about a center of mass or even the concept of other, the fact that these are two separate atomic objects, every one of those elements requires some basis in measurement. However, even when we're talking about religious theories, they still have some basis in measurement. Otherwise, there's nothing rational to pin even the idea that the religious claim could be rational. It still has to be pinned in some sort of measurement. When I say, where do we go when we die? What does it mean to die? What is a we? What is go? When we're talking about life on other planets, what is a life? What are planets? What does it mean to be an other? These things require, to even have a coherency to the question itself, we need to have something based in measurement. Some people will say, well, what about deductive logic? Deductive logic doesn't require measurement. That's just pure logic. And so just to point out, I agree that logic, my point here is that logic and rationality are not actually synonyms. They're not actually the same thing. So deductive logic does not depend on measurement, but deductive soundness, whether we can say that this syllogism is sound, actually does depend on measurement. I'll give you the example here. So syllogism one is kind of the most famous syllogism. It's how we teach what a syllogism is. So we say Socrates is a man, all men are mortal, therefore Socrates is mortal. It follows perfect syllogistic logic. A therefore B, B therefore C, A therefore C. That's exactly right. But when we look at syllogism two, we see Socrates is a man, all men are cats, therefore Socrates is a cat. Now you notice the logic was actually just as valid in the second syllogism as it was in the first syllogism. But this is also crazy. Socrates is not a cat. So there's no way that this works when we're talking about the soundness of deductive logic. But the reason why it doesn't work is because we're starting with a faulty premise. We're saying all men are cats. Now, if it were true that all men are cats, then this would actually be a sound syllogism. All Socrates is a man, all men are cats, Socrates is a cat. That would make it sound. But we say that this premise is not true, but the only reason why we can say that is because of measurement, because we measure that all men are not cats. And so that's why this syllogism, while logically valid, is not actually sound, because it still depends upon measurement. Okay, hopefully last philosophical notion, and then we can move on from this. Okay, so we're going to get some philosophical notions out of the way. The idea of numbers, sometimes I have people who will argue that number sets, causality, you know, other logical operators in philosophy, those things are a priori, that they exist independent of measurement. But actually, that's not true. That all of these things are themselves dependent upon measurement as well. So when we're teaching kids the idea of numbers, how numbers work, we don't appeal to some a priori knowledge about the idea of numbers. We appeal to manipulatives, which are physical empirical objects. So we take object one and object, you know, another object one, and we put them together, and that's how we determine, or that's how we teach kids the idea that 1 + 1 = 2. And so without our two fingers, whatever the case might be. The point is that we don't automatically, we don't intuitively understand any of those ideas that are listed there. We learn about them through measurement, through experience of reality. And then lastly, non-intuitive conclusions about reality. There are some things that when I'm talking about what is objectively here, what is objectively rational does not necessarily make it true. These are some good examples of why that would be. So like, for example, if you're Neo in the Matrix, it would be rational for Neo to believe that he's not in the Matrix. If he has no other evidence, no other measurement that tells him that he's in the Matrix, those things that he is measuring should be the basis for why he believes that he's actually in the Matrix. The point being, rationality is not ontology. So just because it would be rational for Neo to believe that, that doesn't necessarily make it the true. Okay, so that's the first assertion. Rationality begins with measurement. The second assertion is rationality is a causal relationship between two or more entities. So essentially what we're doing is when we're talking about what are we doing when we do rationality? Rationality is essentially a conditional statement. It's a cause and effect relationship. And in order to have any sort of coherency as to what we're discussing, at least one of those operands needs to be a measured phenomenon. So like we're using an example here I'm jumping ahead here. So what we're doing is we see that we have a measured phenomenon, and from that, we kind of have to go back and say, what caused this measured phenomenon? Now, what I'm gonna do, I'm gonna be using kind of this notation for what I'm discussing here. But what we're saying is we have something that is measured. So we start with the first assertion that rationality begins with measurement. The measured phenomenon is actually the effect. And then we're going backwards and saying, what exactly was it that caused this effect? Now, when we're using deductive logic, we normally draw with this the right arrow. But what we're doing is that's deductive reasoning. What we're doing here is called abductive reasoning. We're starting with the effect and going backwards and saying, what is the most likely cause for this? Now, there's not really a uniform notation for inductive reasoning, but this turnstile symbol is used with some frequency, so I'm gonna use it here. Okay, so here we have an effect. We have a measurement. We see that there's a soccer ball sitting there and a broken window. Now, most of us intuitively would look at this and say, I know exactly what caused this. And I know what caused the broken window. I know why that soccer ball is sitting there. We would look at the broken window and say, well, this is what we're measuring is the broken window. The cause of the broken window is that the ball broke through the window, right? So we have a broken window, we have an effect, and we're trying to answer, what was it that caused the effect? Now, that's a good assumption, right? And most of us would probably, that would be our first assumption, was that, oh, somebody kicked the soccer ball or whatever and knocked it through the window. But we don't know that's what happened. We don't have absolute certainty that that's what happened. We weren't there, we're just measuring kind of the after effect. This is our assumption. It's also, let me propose an alternate hypothesis for what happened here. It's possible that a leprechaun punched a soccer ball sized hole in the window and then left the soccer ball there. We don't know that isn't what's happened, but intuitively our mind says that's less rational, that's less reasonable than arguing that claiming that it's probably just the ball got kicked through. Okay, so the point of this slide is essentially to say this isn't an objective heuristic in the sense that when we're going backwards like that, we can't say with absolute certainty. There's actually no way. It's not in the same way that deductive logic says, if these premises are true, therefore it must follow that the conclusion follows. In this situation, what we're saying is, it's an intuitive heuristic. What we are doing in our brain, something is happening in our brain that says, leprechaun, probably not. But what we're trying to do is pin down, why is that we say, probably the ball broke it, not a leprechaun punching a soccer ball sized hole in it. So, but this is an objective starting point because we're starting with measurements. So essentially, again, the process that we're doing when we're doing rational explanation to explain a phenomenon is that we're going backwards to the cause. Now, it is also possible to use rationality to go forward as well, that we can say, can I rationally conclude what will happen based on these events or these ingredients, you know, what's going to happen with this. But like, as we see from the famous dual slit experiment. So what happened was is that they sent little electrons or photons through a double slit, and there was a behavior that they were not expecting. So anybody who were to perform this experiment now, of course they would know exactly what was going to happen if they were to set up the experiment and perform it exactly the same way again. But the point is that no one could have anticipated what was going to happen before the first time that they did this. This doesn't match our experience, prior to the very first time that anyone performed this experience or experiment. And so they could not have possibly guessed what was going to happen. So even though I would say, yes, you can take a cause and anticipate rationally the effect of that cause, the only way that you can do that is by prior experience, to say, if this scenario, this situation matches another scenario, another prior experience, then sure, I can guess what's going to happen in the future. But without that prior experience, there's no possible way to guess what is going to happen. So logic, deductive logic, we would say goes down the causal chain, and abductive reasoning goes back up the causal chain. Okay, third assertion is that rationality is the explanation that it can count for all relevant phenomena with the least amount of conjecture. So it's important to point out that the ball smashing the glass is actually still conjecture. The leprechaun is conjecture, but one of them is less conjecture than the other. And I think it's hopefully pretty obvious which one is the least amount of conjecture. I've never seen a leprechaun before. There's no leprechaun there in the first place. So these are all things that would cause me to believe that it requires more conjecture to come to the conclusion that that a leprechaun performed the broken window. Okay, so when we're talking about conjecture, it's important to understand the difference between data versus conjecture. Data is anything that I can measure. Conjecture is anything that I can't measure. So when we say that rationality is the explanation, so we're starting with the phenomenon, what can be measured, and going backwards inductively. Rationality is the explanation that I can account for all relevant phenomenon, which is the data, what I can measure, with the least amount of conjecture, what I can't measure. I'm going to just jump over this one. I'm not sure that's the most important thing to talk about. So naturalism, again, I've already pointed this out, but I just want to also mention that this is not a naturalism standard when I'm doing this. For example, dark matter, I'm still not quite sure if we can measure dark matter at this point or not, but the point is that it was still rational to conclude the existence of dark matter before dark matter could have possibly been measured. And because of certain celestial motions. So we measured something in celestial motions, those celestial motions can't be accounted for anything else. And so therefore it is rational to conclude the existence of something that itself cannot be measured. And so I'm not ruling out the idea that I have a feeling and therefore God created that feeling or whatever the case is. This is not arguing that just because something can't be measured, that it is irrational to conclude that that was the thing that caused it. The fourth assertion is that a rational explanation must account for all relevant data and measurement. And so I'm meaning with this fourth and fifth assertion, I'm going to actually give you two sort of slightly different definitions of sufficient. And that's essentially what the fourth assertion and the fifth assertion are. When I say in this situation, when I say that the explanation is sufficient, that means that I can account for everything that is being measured. When I give the explanation of the soccer ball smashing the window, that accounts for all the data that I can see. I can see that there's a soccer ball, I can see there's a broken window. The theory that the soccer ball broke the window sufficiently accounts for all that data. But it's important to know also that the leprechaun explanation also accounts for all the available data. There's a ball, there's a window. My theory was that the leprechaun smashed the window and then set the ball there. That does actually account for it in this idea, this meaning of sufficient, that it sufficiently accounts for everything that we can measure. Okay, this is just kind of a quick side note, I just wanted to also point out that data is a moving target, and so therefore rationality is a moving target too. If there was some other data, some other measurement that I was taking as part of this kind of crime scene of the broken window or whatever, then that may completely change what is the most rational explanation for what happened here. And so some people kind of get the idea that, well, then deductive logic is better. Well, the deductive logic is still, as I pointed out earlier, still rests on defeasible premises that it's still based on what is measurable. Okay, fifth assertion, this is the other half of the equation of sufficient. So the fifth assertion is that rationality can only include necessary conjecture. Okay, so again, now we're seeing kind of an objective way to split out the two definitions or the two explanations for the broken window and the soccer ball. The first explanation that the soccer ball broke the window, that is sufficient in that it accounts for all the data. The leprechaun is also sufficient in that it also accounts for all the data. But when we're looking at the fifth assertion that it only includes necessary conjecture, now all of a sudden we can see a difference between these two explanations for the broken window. That the leprechaun is actually, there's nothing measured that requires the existence of a leprechaun in order to explain the data, in order to explain what we can see. And so what I mean by sufficient, when I say sufficient, I'm saying that the explanation needs to be enough, account for all the data, and then not too much, not including unnecessary conjecture. And then again, just to point out that every theory includes some conjecture. So like I get up in the morning and I go and grab some milk out of the fridge, it's possible that I can explain that milk being there being that I went to the store and I bought that milk and there it is, right? And so another possible explanation is that I went and bought that milk and then in the middle of the night, somebody from Tibet broke into my house and switched it with another jug of milk that was exactly identical to the jug of milk that I bought at the store. Both of those explanations sufficiently account for the data, but one of them requires totally and wholly unnecessary conjecture in order to add the guy from Tibet who breaks into my house. It just simply isn't necessary. And so it wouldn't be rational for me to conclude that somebody from Tibet, unless there is some sort of evidence that makes it impossible to conclude without believing that somebody from Tibet broke into my house, that the more rational explanation is that it's just the same jug of milk that I had there the night before. Okay, when we start getting, some people are, they just really, really want their pet belief to be included in the explanation. And so kind of the purpose of this slide is just to kind of show that as soon as you start including unnecessary conjecture, there's no end to what it is that you can conclude, right? So I have a feeling from watching a sunset and somebody could say, well, God caused that sunset or God caused that feeling, whatever the case might be. But we could also say that there's a great cow in the sky who created God, and there could be a Prius who created the cow, and Shia LaBeouf, or however you say his name, is, you know, a magical guy in the sky who created the Prius. Literally, you could go on and on forever and ever if you do not stop with just what is necessary to explain what is being measured. The only thing that's being measured in the situation is there's the sun, there's a feeling. I can explain that the feeling came from watching the sunset. And of course, the point being with all of this, that it's very hard to accept that your belief is actually unnecessary conjecture when that belief is the thing on the chopping block. If we're starting, I really, really want there to be a guy from Tibet who broke into my house last night. It can be very hard to just accept that there's nothing about what is being measured that requires such a conjecture in order to explain what is being measured. Kind of the way that we sort of protect that belief is by, or at least one of the ways that we use to protect that belief is by gravitating to something like you can't prove it's not true, which is actually burden shifting. So if you're the one claiming that there was a leprechaun who broke the window, or you're the one claiming that there was a guy from Tibet who broke into your house to switch the milk out, the burden is on you to demonstrate that there's something about what is being measured that requires or necessitates that belief in order to add it into the explanation. Even if you don't like this heuristic, it's actually impossible to avoid. And this is actually what William of Ockham, we're talking about Ockham's razor here. Ockham's razor does not say the simplest answer is usually correct. That's actually not what William of Ockham was arguing at all. What he actually said, not in English, but translated into English, what he actually said was, plurality is not to be positive without necessity. And so he's actually describing exactly the heuristic that I am talking about right here. So what we're saying is, when we talk about plurality, it's kind of like that slide where we could see, you know, it could go on and on and on forever and ever. You can keep adding unnecessary conjecture forever and ever and ever. But we don't add unnecessary conjecture unless it is necessary. And so that's the point that we're trying to get at here. Isaac Newton actually said something very, very similar in his work called Principia. He says, rule number one, we are to admit no more causes of natural things than are both true and sufficient to explain their appearance. So don't go beyond what is sufficient to explain what it is that we are measuring. But the word true, it's a little bit problematic because, like I said, with the idea of ontology, I can't guarantee that it's true. What I'm guaranteeing, though, is that it's unnecessary, or it's actually necessary because we have to account for what is being measured. And in fact, Albert Einstein also said something very, very similar when he said, it can scarcely be denied that the supreme goal of all theory, so in other words, explanation, the goal of explaining things is to make the irreducible basic elements as simple and few as possible. And again, I kind of bristle at the word simple, but when he's saying as few as possible, he's saying don't include a necessary conjecture without having to surrender the adequate representation of a single datum of experience. So he's basically giving us the two sides of the term that I use, sufficient. Don't include a necessary conjecture, make sure that it accounts for everything. Okay, the sixth assertion is the phenomena of measured data get preeminence in explaining the measured data. Now, this again, people kind of freak out because they're saying, well, it sounds like you're talking about naturalism or something, that you're saying if it's measured, it gets the preeminence. But all I'm arguing here is that if we were to look at these two possible explanations, I measure something that looks like a cow in both of these explanations. All I'm saying here is that the explanation of cow should get preeminence over the explanation of leprechaun. So what I mean is, if I see something that looks like a cow, I should assume that that's a cow, unless there's something else that is measured that gives me a good reason to believe that that's actually not a cow. But without a measurement of a leprechaun, I shouldn't start with the explanation that that was a leprechaun instead of a cow. Some people might look at this then and say, well, this idea of cow, therefore cow, is circular. But really, what I'm really saying is, I have a measurement. I'm taking a measurement, and that measurement is a thing that looks like a cow. And so, barring any other evidence or any other data that might cause me to think otherwise, I should start with the explanation that requires the least amount of conjecture. So this is the most basic conjecture that you can make, is that the thing that you're measuring is that thing. Okay. And then some people might flip it on the other side and say, well, is that even conjecture? Are we even conjecturing when I say I'm looking at something that looks like a cow and so therefore a cow? There is a thing called the Gettier problem. And so just so that you know, this is actually a reality this is actually conjecture to say cow, therefore cow. Okay, the seventh assertion, rationality is determined by comparison to other theories. Okay, so what we're objectively doing when we're trying to determine whether a cause is necessary or unnecessary is by comparing it to another explanation. So just as I've been doing here with the different comparisons of different things, in order to say that this explanation is irrational, that this cause is unnecessary, is I've come up with another explanation that actually I can explain all the data with less conjecture than this explanation. And so in order for it to be objective, in order to say that we're measuring, what we're doing is we're comparing one explanation to another explanation. So again, the only theories that can be in the running are the ones that can account for all the data. That was the fourth assertion. That was the first definition of sufficient, that it can account for all of the data. And then only the one with the least conjecture gets the crown of being what is rational. And so the question then comes in, if you were assuming two or more theories, how do we choose between those two or more theories? Okay, so if we have competing theories, let's just say that we have three competing theories for a specific measured phenomenon. In one situation, we have just this cause A, whatever A is. In this other explanation, we have a cause A plus cause B. And then another one, we have a just totally different cause, something altogether. And so first I'm going to look at kind of a comparison between this explanation where it's it's cause A plus cause B versus just cause A. But the point is, in all of these, we're assuming that these explanations are sufficient to explain the measured phenomenon. So A is sufficient, A plus B is sufficient, Z is sufficient. And it's also important to remember, again, rationality is not ontology. Every one of these theories can be wrong. I'm just saying these are the theories that I have available to me that can account for the measured phenomenon. So let's look at what I call comparing as overlapping conjecture sets. So what I'm saying is it's a comparison between this A plus B versus A. So like what we would say, when I go back to the magic trick where I say theory one is that I opened my fingers and then I closed them back again. And that's how I performed that magic trick. Theory two is that, so that would be A, that would be the A. Theory two would be, sure, you opened your fingers, but you were only able to open your fingers because of leprechaun magic. And so that would be the B. And so what we're saying here is that it's possible both of those theories can sufficiently account for the data. The fingers open and close back up again, that explains what was measured, what we saw. So some examples of this are that when we say, I can see how you could have done the trick by opening your fingers on your own, but maybe leprechaun magic caused you to open your fingers. This is kind of the feel of how somebody's comparing these two theories. I can see how the universe could have happened without a god, but maybe God helped everything along. I can see how Joseph Smith could have produced the Book of Abraham without supernatural aid, but maybe God helped him come up with ideas that he could have just come up with by himself. I can see how a car can move without an invisible car pushing monster, but it's possible that an invisible car pushing monster helps the engine. So when we have conjecture sets like this, overlapping conjecture sets like this, the way that we do this is by shaving away the unnecessary cause. So if we were to say, here is the outcome, here's what is measured. And we can see that, and this is actually just simple math, essentially. This is just substitution math, where we just say, if I know that A plus B equals C, and I know that A equals C, I also know that I can essentially just shave away the B in order to understand the C. So when we're talking about what is the most likely explanation, what is the most rational explanation for this, fingers plus leprechaun gives me the trick. Fingers by themselves gives me the trick. Leprechauns is an unnecessary part, an unnecessary cause in explaining how I did the magic trick. Okay, what about conjecture sets that don't overlap? So I have an explanation A, and then I also have an explanation Z. We're not talking about explanations that overlap. We're just talking about two possible explanations that really are, they don't have anything to do with one another. They're not related to one another. So what I suggest in terms of objectively doing this is to work inside of the box, as opposed to working outside of the box. So these are some examples from science where the explanation itself may or may not be measured itself, but the point is that when we start with certain celestial motions, we try to account for those celestial motions with something itself which has been measured. And then when we cannot do that, then we jump outside of the box. We first start by working inside the box. What can we measure that could have caused this? And then work out when we can't, we get to the point where we can't explain the celestial motions with what has been measured. Then it's okay to step outside of the box and suppose the idea or the existence of dark matter. We also, and this is another scientific thing, we see certain stellar radiation dimming around certain stars. And so it would kind of became big news that it's possible that we've discovered this thing called Dyson spheres, which is the hypothesis of an advanced alien civilization that has created some sort of tool to extract all of the energy from their local star. Now that awesome, I think that'd be totally cool. We found aliens, and that would be great. The problem is that we haven't ruled out all possible measured entities first. And that's the reason it's not that scientists don't want to find Dyson spheres. Scientists have every desire whatsoever to be the first person, astronomers to be the first person to have discovered true evidence of alien civilizations. But we can't do this until we have first ruled out the what has been measured, what can be measured. And so this eagerness to conjecture, this eagerness to have a pet belief that and to prove that the evidence supports our pet belief actually works against rationality. We have to first start by saying, what's anything that's been measured, and can what has been measured account for what is being expressed, what's the phenomenon? And if we can find anything that's been measured, and that thing that's been measured can account for it, we need to use that as the explanation, not the pet belief, not the thing that can be measured. So again, this would be like our A versus Z theory. In theory one, I opened my fingers. In theory two, I didn't open my fingers, but somehow leprechaun magic caused my fingers to go together. So again, my seventh assertion is that I need to work inside of the box. I need to start by saying, but open fingers can account for it. Whether or not that's actually what happened, the rational explanation is that I opened my fingers because I already have evidence that fingers can open. And so that should be the explanation. And that's actually why our brains naturally gravitate to that explanation versus leprechauns. So just a couple of other examples. We have, see crop circles. One possible explanation is aliens. Another possible explanation is some kid went out there and did this. So again, between these two explanations, some kid is the working inside the box. That's working with explanations that themselves are measured. They're, even though I didn't see a kid doing that, I know that kids are capable of doing this. I know that humans could in theory do this. And so until I have ruled out some kid or, some other measured explanation for things, I shouldn't jump to the alien explanation for crop circles. Okay, so there's one other thing, and this kind of goes back to, this is actually another thing that Isaac Newton had said when in his Principia. This is actually rule number two. We didn't cover this, but this is rule number two. There's a possibility that I see an apple falling. And now in this situation, what I'm saying is that over here in this area, I see an apple falling. And then over in another area, I see another apple falling. Now it's possible that I could say, well, sure, that apple falling over there was because of gravity. And then this apple falling over here was because of a tricksy demon. So what Newton was arguing was, he said, if I can't tell the difference between this phenomenon and this phenomenon, I should assume that they have the same cause. So if I see an apple falling over here, now it could be gravity, they could both be gravity, or they could both be a tricksy demon. And we can come up with reasons why gravity is the more logical, more rational explanation for the apples falling. But if I see a phenomenon and there's nothing measurable to distinguish between this apple falling and that apple falling, I should just assume that they both have the same cause. There are reasons, we're kind of running short on time, so I'm not going to talk about this, but there are reasons why we would pick gravity over tricksy demon. And then also, there's one other kind of rule that we should employ as we're doing this, is that even if I can't fully explain the mechanics of that thing that has been measured, I should still go with the thing that has been measured, not the thing that hasn't been measured. So when I say, yeah, but fingers open and close because of brains. Well, how do you know the leprechaun didn't make your brain? Or how do you know that it was the leprechaun doing it instead of your brain? Well, I don't understand exactly how brain, nobody understands exactly down to the minute detail exactly how brains work, what exactly brains are doing. But the point, and it could be that leprechauns are causing brains to do this. But the point is that where there's still potential within the measured entity to explain this, then we should just go with potential of measured entity, not start employing unnecessary entities when this could potentially cover it. Okay, I'm kind of almost out of time, so I wanted to tell this story, but I may not have quite as much time. But the point of this this is a really fun friendship that formed that actually turned into kind of they kind of became enemies a little bit later in life. But Houdini was very, very much about debunking spiritualist movements. He would actually go into spiritual seances and whatnot and show them how the trick was actually being done. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was a very intelligent man. This is the guy who wrote Sherlock Holmes, but he believed very strongly in the spiritualist movement. But more importantly to this story, he actually thought what Houdini was doing was going in there and using his, he believed in not only seances, but he believed that Houdini himself was magic, and he was using his magic to disrupt the power of the seance. And so essentially what we have here is we've got one guy who's basically going in and saying, here is the most rational explanation. This explanation can much more easily account for what we're seeing in the seance than what the seance person is arguing. Whereas Doyle is essentially saying, I'm conjecturing that the seance powers are real. And then in order to explain why it was so easily debunked, I'm gonna add even more conjecture to my explanation to say, well, there was magic and then magic on top of magic to explain why there doesn't look like it's magic. And so we can see that it's objectively, we can take this and say, whatever Houdini is doing here, where he's actually going through and showing, these are the little tricks. I'm a magician. I know how tricks work. I know that, you know, fingers open and whatnot. That I don't need the magical explanation in order to explain what it is that's being measured. Okay, eighth assertion is essentially just kind of a wrap up of everything that we've talked about at this point. So rationality is incompatible with confidence and faith-based claims. So again, just wanna make sure that we point out the idea that we are saying, when I'm saying rationality and faith are incompatible, I'm using very specific objective definitions for what I mean when I'm talking about rationality versus what I'm talking about with faith. With faith, I'm talking about that orange line. It's belief despite the evidence or even against, contrary to the evidence. Rationality is epistemic rationality. These are the good reasons, these are the assertions that I've given for why it is that we should believe one explanation versus another explanation. Some biblical explanations or biblical examples of faith as a virtue, just to kind of confirm what it is, the definition I'm using. I'll just use the example of the Peter walking on water. So Peter is kind of praised for having faith for walking on water. And sometimes people will say, well, but they just saw Jesus walking on water. And so therefore he's working on evidence that it's possible to walk on water. And that's why he has faith. And I would argue that that's not at all the reason why Jesus is praising Peter for walking on water. Because if we're saying that it was based on evidence, then Jesus should be giving all kinds of praise for Peter for walking on land. So you see the difference here is that essentially walking on land, there is much, much, much more evidence for walking on land. And so having confidence in that evidence should mean that Jesus should be crazy praised for Peter for walking on the land. That's not really what we mean when we're talking about faith in terms of the virtue of faith in the Bible. Okay, so just to wrap up some common objections to some of the things that I've been arguing here. Sometimes people say, I recognize my beliefs are rational, but I just want to believe it. As I mentioned at the very, very beginning, great. If you already understand that you believe some things that aren't rational, go for it, as long as you're not hurting anybody. The universe is full of possibilities. You can't prove my belief is false. This is burden shifting. That's great. There might possibly be leprechauns. There might possibly be a guy from Tibet who switched out your milk last night. That the burden is not on me to disprove those things. The burden is on the person who is claiming that those things are true. Lots of people or really smart people believe this. This kind of goes back to the idea that, you know, somebody like Alistair McGrath believes that faith is compatible, whatever. Those are one of two fallacies and could be both. The bandwagon fallacy is lots of people believe this, or appeal to authority is that smart people believe this. Still doesn't make it rational. That's just a fallacy. We start from the belief that God exists. And if you start from the belief that God exists, then it's totally rational. It's like if we draw a deductive thing where we start from that premise and then work to a conclusion, that's not really, as we talked about in the deductive logic section, that's not really what rationality is. We can't start from a premise that itself is in question as to whether or not it's rational in order to derive that the conclusion is rational. Abductive reasoning has issues. It does, yes. But you're going to run with the same issues anywhere. If God is not real, then where do math, justice, morality, and whatnot come from? I don't have time to get into this, but feel free, we can chat about it later, but absolutely, these things can be explained with natural causes. So sometimes people will say, well, my religious beliefs, even using the objective definition that you just used for rationality, some people will say that belief is also the most rational explanation. And I would say, if it's true, if you have followed each of these assertions, steps, I guess, and yes, you have demonstrated that your religious belief is the most rational, then you don't need faith. At that point, we're not talking about faith anymore. And so I would still say, even if your beliefs are the most rational explanation for something, then that's no longer faith. Bayesian math proves a belief that God is rational. If you believe, there are some people who actually believe this and claim this. If you do, I would just recommend reading Richard Carrier's article on Unnecessary Unsupportable Priors. And then very last, to close, this is kind of just a joke, and it's an equivocation, but the most basic conjecture that you can possibly make is to believe in yourself. That you, therefore you, is actually the most basic conjecture. And so even when I'm talking about beliefs that might be a little bit crazy, might be irrational, whatever the case is, as long as it's not hurting anyone, I don't want to step on anybody's dreams. I don't want to step on somebody's desire to go out and do something that's a little bit crazy. That's not the point of why I'm doing this. I want you to believe in yourself. I want you to go out and do great things and big things and whatnot. And so with that is the end, and I am ready for questions if we want to have some questions.
Okay, thank you, Spencer. We do have a few questions, and I would encourage everybody to use the Whova app to ask any more that you might have while he's answering these. I will start first with a question from Bryce Hammond, and he says, St. Thomas Aquinas had a mystical experience which seems to have caused him to think all he had written in Summa Theologica was straw. Do you think he realized his theology wasn't rational?
I honestly do not know the details of that, so I'm not sure whether he thought he realized that the theology wasn't rational. But again, what I would say to like specific examples of does someone think what they're doing is rational or irrational, I would, just like when I used Alistair McGrath's example, I think that Alistair McGrath, even when he's doing what I would consider to be cheating by kind of changing around the terminology, I don't think that he's doing that like in some sort of evil, underhanded way, like that he knows what he's doing, but he's still doing it anyway. I think he truly believes that he has kind of found some sort of compatibility between faith and rationality by kind of changing around the terms and making them, defining them different than what we do in everyday situations. And so when we're talking about Thomas Aquinas, did he have a experience that made him think that it was rational, or that he made it think it wasn't rational, or whatever the case is. I would start with the assumption that people are being genuine when they're saying, I think that these are compatible. I think that, whatever the case may be. And so again, I don't know. Did somebody add some more to it? Oh, no additional stuff. That I would start with the assumption that people are being genuine in what they're doing. So if he started with the assumption that he was being rational, I'm sure he believed he was being rational. If he started from the assumption that he wasn't being rational, I don't think he's lying about that.
Okay. Next question is from Kim Lewis. And Kim asks, what about this idea that we have to act without enough rational information? Sometimes I have to use intuition because there isn't enough research yet. I have to deduce with partial information.
Yes, and I would actually agree with that, but I would actually take it a step further. I would say that we always work without enough information. That again, what we're talking about is we're saying this is not ontology. But, in fact, what I tell people frequently is I say, if I lived in ancient Greece And I had no concept of subatomic particles, or no idea of like some other explanation for lightning. I think it would be rational to believe that Zeus was casting lightning. I haven't, so again, like the, I think it was the seventh assertion where I was talking about how rationality has to come by comparison to some other explanation. I have to have some better explanation that can account for the data than the explanation that I currently believe. And so without that better explanation, or without better data that would cause me, you know, get me closer and closer to what's actually true, I still have to work with the data that I have. Like, I can't, maybe sometimes we can just say, who knows? I don't know the answer. I don't know what is actually true. I don't know what is actually right. But we're always working under the data set that we have available to us right now. And so that's why I was saying data is changing all the time. We're gaining more data as time goes on. And so somebody who's back here who has this little amount of data versus somebody who has more data over here, I feel more empathy and more kind of give them a break when we're working with a smaller data set versus somebody over here who's working with a larger data set. And so, but even the person over here can, you know, with a smaller data set, when we have possible, two or more possible explanations for what this data is, there is still one of those explanations that is more rational than the other explanations. Over here, we have more data that may limit down the possible explanations that are available. But ultimately, when it comes down to it, one of those explanations, or usually one of those explanations, can account for the data with less conjecture than any other possible explanation. So the heuristic is the same. The heuristic is take all the data, explain all the data, and do it with the least amount of conjectures possible. Over here, same exact thing. Start with the data, try to explain all the data, and use the least amount of conjecture that you possibly can to explain it. And so to go back and answer the question again, sometimes I use intuition because there isn't enough research yet. It is the case every time. Something may come tomorrow where all of a sudden what we thought was a really good amount of data, all of a sudden now it's exploded, and we can see that obviously whatever we thought the day before doesn't really account for the data because now we have a much larger data set. The reality though is at any point along the process, we always kind of have to work with the reality that we're dealing with conjecture.
Okay, the next question. There's another one from Bryce. And the question is, do you think Isaac Newton's extensive engagement with alchemy was irrational? Why would such an irrational scientist be so involved?
Yeah, okay, so Isaac Newton was kind of, sometimes they call Isaac Newton the last of the magicians. He was the first scientist and the last of the magicians. So in Isaac Newton's case, he had no other data to go off of in terms of what he was studying. He was taking measurements to try to understand these phenomena. So when he's trying to transmute, you know, lead into gold or whatever the case is, he has no basis for knowing what the outcome. This is kind of goes back to that double slit experiment. He has no idea what these experiments are going to, you know, what's going to happen as a result of these experiments. So for him, for Isaac Newton at his moment in time, with the amount of data that he has available, there's nothing irrational about what he's doing. He's starting with a hypothesis. He's got this amount of data that causes him to move forward and try things out and see what happens as a result of this. Nowadays, we have a lot more data that would probably say these things are probably not really worth the time that Isaac Newton spent on them. And so what I would say, just in the same way that I would say somebody who lives in ancient Greece, it wouldn't really be irrational for them to believe Zeus was causing the lightning. It wouldn't really be irrational for Isaac Newton to believe that he could transmute lead into gold. So why would a rational scientist be so involved? Because Isaac Newton lived in the 1700s. That's why.
Okay, we have about 10 more minutes. We have a question from Laura. She says, is there any way to get someone who is typically a rational thinker to see the irrationality in the beliefs of the LDS faith, or do they just have to come to their own conclusions in their own timetable?
So I have found that it kind of very much depends on the person. I've spoken with, you know, kind of had many, many discussions with lots of people, including lots of LDS believers. And some of them, as we have kind of gone through this process to talk about kind of the nature of, like, the nature of objective rationality, to say, if we agree with these assertions that I'm making, these seven assertions, is it not pretty easy to see that the idea that Joseph saw an angel versus Joseph just claimed to have seen an angel, that it's pretty easy to see which of those two is the more rational explanation, barring something else that necessitates the existence of an angel actually being there. The more rational explanation is that he just said that there was an angel there. So I've actually walked people through this process, and they kind of go, oh, wow, yeah, I kind of see your point. And then pretty soon they don't believe anymore. That's not the normal, you know, that's not my normal experience. My normal experience is that I will try to walk people through this process, and they either don't want to hear it, or they've heard it, and then when they're all done, they just go right back and act like they never heard a word of it. And so, for some people it works. For some people it doesn't. So just it to, and you know you got to kind of season the taste. You got to kind of know, reach your audience, and know who you're dealing with.
Okay, we have another question. This was asked earlier and you answered it online, but I'd like to ask you here. Do you think that spirituality might exist in a place that is transrational, beyond the limits of the rational mind? How is this different than saying it is irrational?
Do I think that spirituality might exist in a space that is transrational? I'm not sure that I necessarily agree with the premise of the question, that as far as I am concerned, as I said before, I do not believe that because something is rational, that automatically means that it is true. And so something might be true that is also irrational. Like just because the more rational explanation is that Joseph probably just said that he saw an angel rather than Joseph actually saw an angel, that doesn't mean that he didn't see an angel. And so we could start by the presumption that, well, even if it's not rational, I just want to believe it anyway. I can't make it be the explanation that accounts for all the data with the least amount of conjecture, but I still want to believe it anyway. And does that make it transrational? I mean, there still has to be some reason why you want that explanation to be true versus why you're not going with more rational explanation. Right. And is there a state called transrational where that exists? What I would just say is, what is the reason why you really want to believe this to be true? And it makes me feel good. It gives me hope. And, you know, whatever reason it is that makes you want to believe it, even though it's not the most rational explanation, it might be true. Maybe Joseph really did see an angel. That's possible. But I would still say it's not the rational explanation. And so, I suppose there's a gray area where what we're hoping is the rational explanation is also the correct explanation, is also the ontologically true explanation. There's no guarantee that anything we believe is the, you know, even if it is truly the rational explanation, it doesn't guarantee it's the true explanation. But the goal is, either are you trying to find the explanation that's likely true, or do you just really want to believe this thing? If you just really want to believe that thing, believe it. You know, not hurting anybody, then whatever.
Okay, we have about 5 more minutes. If anyone wants to raise their hand in the app to ask a question.
Oh, I do see one other question down here at the bottom. It says, has your understanding of rationality led you to agnosticism, atheism? So my understanding where I'm employing these principles to try to come up with the best, most rational explanation for what it is that I measure. I kind of started this with a magic trick, and it partially that's because I'm kind of a amateur magician. I've loved magic my whole entire life. Probably more than anything, magic has led me to more of a position of agnosticism, atheism than anything else. And it's and I suppose I can say yes, it's this what I've discussed here, this rationality. But the point is that when you watch like a David Copperfield and you kind of see him do this amazing trick where he walks through the Great Wall of China or he flies or something like that, and it looks amazing, and you don't have an alternate explanation for why he did those things. And so you it kind of makes you believe in magic, like, you know, there's a possibility that maybe David Copperfield is really magic. And so, but of course, I have this other part of my brain that just keeps having to dig and try to find, is there some other explanation, a more, you know, empirical, you know, physical, real, more realistic explanation for what he did. And then you kind of come across these things, or you kind of figure it out yourself, and you kind of make this realization that, oh, wait, there's actually a really, really simple explanation for how he flew. There's a really, really simple explanation. And when I'm saying simple, what I mean is I can explain this all without magic. So I, by finding this other explanation, I've come to the realization that it's magic is the more conjectured explanation for what he's done. And as soon as I did that, then all of a sudden it kind of makes magic sort of, you know, kind of disappear in terms of I've got this evidence that David Copperfield can really fly, or that he can really walk through the Great Wall. If you want to know how he did it, I can tell you, and but again, maybe he really did use magic. Maybe the explanation that I have isn't actually what he did, but unfortunately, it's the explanation that can account for all the data with the least amount of conjecture.
We do have one last question here. Do you ever get discouraged by the lack of rational thinking in our society at large, politics, religion, etc.?
Yes. So yes, very, very much so. And honestly, so my concern has always been not with religion itself, but the effect of religion on society. And I don't mean religion in like that you're going out and helping your fellow man and doing service projects. What I mean is the type of thinking that is necessary in order to believe that David Copperfield actually has magic, and then start applying that magical thinking into the voting booth. And that's always been my concern. And this is the whole reason why I want to teach people how to think rationally, so that not so that they can stop believing. If you want to believe in Joseph Smith, or you want to believe in your religious beliefs, whatever, as long as you're not hurting anybody else, that's just fine. But when you go and start doing, you know, Prop 8 stuff in California, or you start doing other things where you're going out of your way to hurt other people because you believe in your magical beliefs, then now it's a danger to other people. And so what I would really hope is people, you know, like I said, I like Shinto and whatever. There's not a single thing about Shinto that I carry over into the voting booth in terms of irrational beliefs. Like, you know, there are values. I have values, but even those values I tie to something that's more of this world, as opposed to something that is, you know, a magical kami sort of reason behind why I share a value or hold a value. So yeah, absolutely, yes. And that would be my hope, that if you can take away one thing away from this, is can we please just use rationality when we're talking about in the public sphere?
Okay, our time is up. Spencer, thank you so much. Very thought-provoking discussion, and gave us a lot to think about.
And thank you so much, everybody. Yeah, everybody that came, thank you so much, appreciate it.
Yeah, and I'm sure that you would love to answer some more questions online if they have any later.
Absolutely. Yep. I'll jump back in and answer any questions that I can.
Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure. We'll close this one up, and we'll see you in the next session, guys.
Thank you, everybody.